Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My guest today is Rosemary Sullivan, has written several books on the Soviet era under Stalin, among them Stalin's Daughter, which we are going to discuss today. And of course, as always on this podcast, I want to begin with, how did you come about studying this era of the Soviet Union?
Perhaps it was because in 1979, in the height of the Cold War, I was living in London and saw an ad for Aeroflot trips to the Soviet Union. And so I decided to go on my own. I went to Moscow. I went to Leningrad, as it was then called. I met the BBC reporter there, Kevin Ruane, through a friend, and I became fascinated by how the Soviet system worked. I won't go into detail, but I began to understand that the way to get ahead in the Soviet Union in those days was betrayal. When I got back to Canada, I joined Amnesty International and set up a very large Congress called the Writer and Human Rights in aid of Amnesty International. And everyone from Josef Brodsky to Susan Sontag to Jacobo Timmerman to Eduardo Galeano came. And ever since then, I then returned to Czechoslovakia. Within a few months, my colleague where I was teaching at the University of Toronto was Joseph Skoretsky, who had gone into exile in 1968 with the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia. And when I went back to Czechoslovakia, I met his friends. I was able to read his books, or see his books at least, in Samizdat. So it was totally compelling to me. In 2011, there was in the New York Times and in the Toronto Star notice of the death of Svetlana Allilujeva, Stalin's daughter. And by coincidence, I was talking to my publisher, editor in New York at HarperCollins, Claire Wachtel. And we spoke about how fascinating that life would be. And I said, gee, it would be really interesting to write that life. And she said, do it. I said, but I don't speak Russian. She said, good, because I don't want a historian who has a bone to pick. I'd like somebody who's an independent outsider to write this. So she said, I'll give you 10 days to write a proposal, which I did, a 20-page proposal describing the kind of research I would do. And then there were two stages. One was to get permission from Svetlana's daughter, Olga, as she was called then, to write the biography and using published and unpublished sources. And the second was to find myself research assistants who would accompany me when I was ready to go to Moscow. So I found two wonderful young women, Anastasia Kostryakova and Elena Romanova, to help me do the research, the Russian research. But as you know, Svetlana defected in 1967. And after that, between 67 and 2011, everything was in English.
So let's begin with her early life, because as you know, it would never be easy to grow up being the children of Stalin, the Red Tsar, as he is called. And of course, I think the testimony to this is her brother's fate, destinies as well, one becoming an alcoholic and the other throwing himself during the Second World War to a fence in a concentration camp and dying there. So it wasn't even for Svetlana, of course. If I remember correctly, she was Stalin's favorite. It was never going to be easy life for her. So let's begin with her early years. As we talked about, that was the most happiest time of her life.
The happiest time of her life, perhaps apart from the first days of her marriage to Wesley Peters, or to Braja Singh. The happiest days of her life, which she called those days of sunshine, were her childhood years from till she was 6 and a half. The summers would be spent at the dacha in Zubalovo, which was formerly owned, of course, by the czars. Very elegant residences, though the Bolsheviks divided them up so that they probably had only a small one. But gardening, going fishing with her grandfather, family dinners, her mother always busy, but there. Svetlana had a difficult relationship with her mother because her mother was trying to be a Bolshevik wife, which meant going off to party meetings, trying to educate herself in certain ways. And when Svetlana spoke about her mother, she said she had very little. The only thing she remembered was her mother leaning over her and she could smell her perfume. She didn't remember embraces. She did remember one lesson from her mother, which was her mother took her finger and crossed Svetlana's heart and said, "That's where you keep your secrets," which is rather sinister, right? Mm. But her relationship with her father, when her mother and father would fight, Svetlana would put her arms around her father's Cossack boots and he would quiet down. She was the one who had an intimate relationship with him until her mother's death. She did not know it. In fact, only a very, very small circle of people knew that Svetlana's mother, Nadezhda, had committed suicide. Svetlana just thought her mother had died. What happened was Stalin moved the family to an apartment in the Kremlin, and Svetlana would have to sit through every meal with the members of the Politburo, whether it was Beria or Khrushchev or whatever. She always said that her political shrewdness came from watching how there was double talk at that table. There was official stuff, and then there was the private, conspiracy material that was explaining what the official version really was about, which was fascinating. So she then became the apple of her father's eye. He would call her his little hostess. She would send him a note. He was first secretary. Beria was second secretary, etc. She'd write to the first secretary saying she wanted to go to the movies, and he would write back, "I submit, J. Stalin," or he would sign himself the poor peasant, J. Stalin. He always called her himself her little daddy. That relationship lasted till she was 16, and then it fell apart.
Before that, though, I want to talk about her brother as her relationship with her brothers as well, because it kind of, to me, sounds a little bit like a medieval royal family, where they wouldn't go along, and there would be quarrels about the throne, etc. So no royal families ever really got along that well. But and it would be kind of the same here as well, because she would be bullied really quite a lot by her brothers. And, Vasily would even tell her sexual stories that would put her off sexual adventures for quite some time, that would never be a siege sexual pleasure as well.
Her relationship with her brothers, I can only comment on what she wrote about it. And so about her older brother, she said that he took care of her. He was the one who watched over her. He was her half brother, her step brother. Born in the Caucasus with Stalin's first wife. She didn't see him until, he was well into his teens and she was growing up. So that was a very moving and positive relationship, but it ended tragically when he was captured by the Allies and imprisoned. And eventually, rather than being used as a tool and so on, he committed suicide. Her relationship with her other brother was quite a bit different. I would say that he was only a few years older than her, 5 years older. She always said that when her mother died, he was her favorite. And when she died, he was never the same. He began to drink, to use drugs, to fraternize with women. He had at least three marriages, probably four, if I think about it. It was as if he became the parody of the dictator's son, using his power ruthlessly whenever he had to. That Stalin cared for him seems to be suggested by the fact that he never allowed him to be involved in any aviation exercises, or indeed to fight as a pilot in the war, because he was protecting him. That said, Stalin's preoccupation during the war was elsewhere, obviously. So her relationship with her brothers was, I would say, quite distant in a way, except, yeah.
So, but, before that, he was never going to succeed Stalin even before he became an alcoholic, right? But there was never talk. Was there any hope that he would succeed him before he became an alcoholic, or was there never question of doubts that he wouldn't?
No, I don't think there was any. After Stalin died in 1953, he became even more aggressive in his demand to be a member of the ruling elite. Mm. Until eventually Khrushchev had him arrested and put in prison as a kind of way of curing his alcoholism. But when he got out, he went back to his old ways. Mm. I remember I met, when I was in Moscow, I met one of his sons, can we take a break?
Of course. We'll be right back after this. And we're back. So yeah, you remember, she forgot the name, but that's, you found it again. So you met his son.
I just wanted to say that when I went to Moscow, I was able to meet the son of Svetlana's brother, Vasily. Obviously, he had changed his name to Sasha Berdonsky. He'd left Stalin and changed to his mother's name, Berdonsky. I spoke to him about his father, and I said to him, your father, Vasily, seemed to be a parody of the dictator. Over-drinking, over-womanizing, trying to manipulate his power. But Svetlana seemed to be completely different. And Sasha said, no, you're wrong. Vasily was just a parody, yes. He was a silly man. What happened was that when he met his second wife, he abandoned his first wife, and his children were put in the care of this woman who neglected them completely. So he said it was a relief to get into the Russian army after his childhood, which is a bit of an extreme statement. But anyway, Sasha Berdonsky said, you're right about Vasily, but you're wrong about Svetlana. Svetlana had her father's organized intelligence. She had his discipline. She just didn't have his evil. Mm. I loved her deeply, he said. Mm.
And another thing that wasn't easy about growing up, because as you know, if you know a little bit about Soviet history, in the Kremlin, they all lived together. And obviously it was quite a close companionship, comradeship, as they would say. And, they would go to school together, the children of the politicians. But as you know, even as a politician, you were safe under the hands of Stalin, and people would suddenly disappear. And that would mean that your friends, school friends, would also disappear, because if your family, your father would disappear and sent to the Gulag, you were no longer obviously welcome to the Kremlin. So that must have been another traumatizing part of her childhood, because she wasn't really explained what happened to her friends, why they disappeared. So it must be, and why the family suddenly got out of the Kremlin. So it can't have been easier. Another thing that can't have been easy for her.
Again, she described her childhood when they all lived together in the Kremlin as wonderful. You know, they would all get together and play on the statues in the yards outside. I talked to some of her childhood friends, and they said everything was good until 1937, when the terror began. By that point, Stalin had begun to become convinced that there were plots against him. He had to secure his power. And at first, it didn't seem to... I mean, you're talking about an 11-year-old child, right? Mm-hmm. She wasn't... What was going on, it wasn't clear. But then one of her school friends, her mother, her father rather, disappeared. And the mother asked the school friend, her daughter, to give Svetlana a letter. Svetlana took the letter to her father, which requested that this man be released. And Stalin was furious. He said, never do anything like this again. Oddly enough, he did secure the release of this man, ordered it, but otherwise. And so Svetlana had no idea really what was going on as she watched slowly members in her own family disappear. She had a favorite aunt and uncle, the Svenitzes, and they disappeared. They were put in Lublyanka, and then they were executed, the prison Lublyanka, and were executed. It was said by historians after that Stalin could then say, look, it's not me, it's happening to my own family. So then she watched her uncle, Pavel, die of a heart attack when he was being accused. She later, by the 40s, saw two of her aunts imprisoned, and they were in prison for about 7 years before they were released. So she began to understand her father's world, but to actually put it as her father's responsibility, that didn't become clear until one specific episode. When she was 16 years old, she apparently, you know, Vasily used to have parties at the dacha and so on. And one of the people who was invited to the dacha was a very well-known filmmaker, and Alexei Kapler. And he took a shine to Svetlana. He said afterwards that what so impressed him was her independence of mind. She seemed to be a free thinker in this world that was so closed down. And they began a very platonic relationship. They'd meet in the opera and go out and walk hand in hand in the park. He would put her hand in his pocket. It was a very chaste relationship. He was then off, it was war, of course. She was then off to, he was then off to filming the front, and sent a letter to her, which got published in the newspaper, which was in effect, I'm looking at you, staring out from the windows of the, of the Kremlin. Stalin was furious, had Alexei Kapler immediately arrested. He was accused of collaborating with British spies, and he was sentenced to 5 years in the north, and another 5 years after he tried to come back to Moscow. So Svetlana watched her father imprison a man who had a chaste and honorable relationship with her, imprisoned for 10 years. Now, the truth was, Alexei Kapler was 39, the same age that that Stalin was when Stalin fell in love with his wife, who was 17, the same, more or less the same age as Svetlana. So Svetlana was repeating what her father did, but it cost her dearly. After that, she began to realize that her father, as she put it in her later book, Only One Year, she said he had emptied himself completely to power and there was no person left.
And but she would meet another one who was no better, at least in Stalin's eyes. Though I believe, I don't, if I know this correctly, I'm going to try to say his name, Grigory Morozov. will be her first husband.
Grisha,
But of course there was another, if I remember correctly, I might not hear, but I believe that he was Jewish as well, which was in Stalin's eyes a big no-no, because of course he was as well a big anti-Semite.
You know, there's some ambivalence among the historians about the degree of Stalin's anti-Semitism. He certainly didn't approve of Muratsov. He thought he was a minor figure. He expected his daughter to marry somebody much more of her own station. But it would also seem that anti-Semitism was part of his response. The child that came from the marriage of Grisha and Svetlana, Joseph, Stalin only met him once in the whole time, and Svetlana was devastated that her father refused to meet him. She eventually, as you know, divorced Morozov and married Yuri Zdanov. Zdanov, the father, was a member of Stalin's inner circle, which was much more in keeping with what Stalin expected for his daughter.
But it was never love, that second marriage with her, if I remember correctly, either.
Not at all. She was marrying because it was her father's suggestion. She was trying to accommodate her father. In fact, again, Sasha Berdonsky, that is Stalin's grandson, always said that if you're the child of a dictator like Stalin, you either have to totally accept him, which was the case, for instance, with the children of some of the Nazis, or you completely reject him. But Svetlana was kind of caught in the middle. It was very hard for her to disavow the affection, the love she felt for her father, possibly also because she had lost her mother. But by the end of her life, in her residence in Wisconsin, there was no photograph of Stalin. There was just a photograph of her mother and her daughter.
I remember watching a recent documentary that came out on Netflix, and where she would get really mad when a reporter would come. She would talk about it eventually, but she would get really mad. I mean, we will talk about this when the end comes as well. But that she would refuse to even talk about Stalin, and that she, at the end of her life.
There were as I think again, Sasha Berdonsky, such a shrewd and intelligent man, he said there were so many myths about Stalin. When people think of Stalin, they think that Stalin himself alone was the Bolshevik system. But in fact, if he hadn't been propped up by the Khrushchevs, you know, whose reputation in the Ukraine was horrific, by Beria, who was a sadist, by others, it was a system that was supported by thousands, is what Svetlana, what made Svetlana angry. And to make it as if it was only Stalin's invention. Yes, Stalin was ruthless enough to understand, you know, how to eliminate any threat. When he died in March of 1953, there's a good case to be made that the next person on his list was Beria, as Beria was getting too powerful. So this was how Stalin, much like it would seem Putin, had to be aware of where the potential rival or threat lay. That was his genius. He was able to see it. But that the system and its murderousness was entirely Stalin's fault made Svetlana angry. And when she was interviewed, for instance, she always felt she was being pushed to confirm this myth of her father as the sinkhole into which all Russian evil could be thrown.
I mean, you can kind of understand the frustration there as well. So let us talk about Stalin's death for a second, because this is when things start. She does stay in the Soviet Union for quite a little while after Stalin's death. So what happens to her Everyone in dies, and you know, Khrushchev takes over.
The film, The Death of Stalin. Seen it?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I mean, it's a parody, it's a satire, but it comes very close to the truth.
And
Though
the scene with Beria really kind of hits quite nicely.
I don't think they get Svetlana quite right. They make her way too passive. But in any case, what happened was, as you know, he died in 53, and then in 56, finally Khrushchev made his secret speech in which he made Stalin responsible for the gulag and for the murderous system and so on. And he ordered the release of hundreds of thousands of prisoners from the gulag. Khrushchev was, of course, not admitting to the fact that he was responsible for the death of millions through famine in the Ukraine. But in any case, he got to be. So there's a poignant moment in which Svetlana is at her university, sitting beside other students, and suddenly Khrushchev, the local party head reports on the secret speech, and Svetlana is profoundly, profoundly humiliated. So that begins her withdrawal. The only way she felt she could save herself was to withdraw publicly. So that was 1956. She at one point she in the 60s she met an Indian man, Brajev Singh, when they were both recuperating from problems in the party hospital. He from lung issues and she from tonsillitis. And a relationship started, which became a very important relationship. Her daughter, Svetlana's daughter, would say it was the most important love affair of Svetlana's life. She wanted to go back to India with Brajev Singh because he was ill. And when she asked Kosygin and Brezhnev if she could go, they said, no, Stalin's daughter will not marry an Indian fakir, as they put it.
We should also mention that she, of course, divorced her second husband as well.
Yes, Muradov, Zdanov, yes. Yeah. In fact, she had a child with Zdanov, Katya. So she had two children from her two marriages in Moscow. And then she was on her own, living quietly, avoiding contact with the public, more or less, though she did have some very important friendships. But then she met Brajiv Singh, as I say, and I'm answering your question about why it took her so long to leave. In all that time, even though she was Stalin's daughter, she'd only visited Moscow and the dachas in Sochi. She did not travel. Then when she couldn't go with Brajiv Singh to India, he died in Moscow, and he'd always asked if she could scatter his ashes on the Ganges. And she went to Brezhnev and Kosygin and asked for permission, and she was on a plane the next day. Sitting beside her was not the man she wanted to marry, but his ashes. And when she was in India, she said she got to the point of it was too much to be treated like state property and told what to do, and that's why she defected.
I mean, I do want to go back a bit to 53 at first, and we know now, obviously, that she had no political ambitions, but at the time of the death of Stalin, because as you said, she was intelligent, she had, you know, everything was silly, was not, so was, and again, probably because she was a woman, but was there ever any fear among the political elite that she would take over after Stalin, that she would try to become head premier of the Soviet Union? Did they try to just get rid of her, or was there ever
She never sought any political position. After Stalin died, she could see, because as I say, she always claimed that having all those that 10 years of dinners with the Politburo members, she could see how they thought. After Stalin died, the battle for successor was between Khrushchev and Beria. Beria was absolutely sure that he was going to be the replacement of Stalin. Actually, there's still a mystery attached to this, which is he was finally put on trial in December of 53, but there is some suggestion he was already dead by the summer. So a dead man was tried. Whether that's true or not is very difficult to ascertain because the KGB files are closed. And in any case, Svetlana could see what the system was, and she was not about to put herself forward as a figure. And she was always, it seems to me, careful to keep herself and her two children separate from the political game, ruthless as it was, that she saw in action.
But so let's go back to the fact she just, and of course, to the fact she did go to the, I mean, is this the point when she goes to the American embassy to talk with the George Kennan at this time?
Yes. One of the things that was interesting is that Svetlana had the ambition to be a writer. She wanted to be a writer. She loved literature. And she had a friend who was a publisher and told her, you know, he told her, look, you have an immensely original story and you should write it. And she said, how can I write it? He said, write it as letters to me. And so 21 letters is her compilation of her childhood in the Kremlin. And it's a very, it ends in effect with Stalin's death, but it's a very powerful portrait of this intelligent young woman describing her grandparents who were, her grandfather who had been an original Bolshevik sideline, the disappearance of her aunt, the imprisonment of others, and watching her father as he withdrew into this zombie of obsessed with paranoia and power. It's a very powerful book. So she gets to Brezhnev Singh, who'd been her lover before she defected, remember, had told her, this is a very dangerous book. You better do something with it. And so she gave the book to a friend of his who was in the Indian embassy, and he took it with him to India. When she got permission from Kosygin and Brezhnev to fly to India with Brezhnev Singh's ashes, and the only reason she was given permission was because there was an arms deal. The Soviets were selling arms to the Indians. She went to the ambassador who had carried her book and asked for it back. She was manipulated by the Russian ambassador to India. You know, he told her, oh, well, you don't need to go to the ceremony in the Ganges. Well, you can't stay in with your friends. You must stay here, et cetera, et cetera. She got so fed up. She said she didn't want to be state property any longer. And she realized that the best solution was to defect to the American embassy, which was not far away. The day of her defection was Women's Day for Russians, and everybody was drunk, as she said, and she wouldn't be missed. She sat there. She'd already bought presents for her children. And she thought, seriously, what would it be like for my children if I defect? And she concluded accurately that it would be, they wouldn't come to any harm, but whether they might forgive her is another question. So she called a taxi. The taxi drove her to the American embassy. She was, it was after hours. They answered. She showed her Soviet passport, which meant she was a defector, and they let her in. The person in charge of defectors was a man called Robert Rail, whom I met later and spent a weekend interviewing him and his wife about this period. Robert Rail brought her to the, you know, the interrogation room, if you want, and one of the diplomats said to her, she said to them, "You may not believe this, but I am Stalin's daughter."
Yeah, but what was their reaction?
Yeah,
when they heard
his
it,
reaction
it must have
was,
been quite surprising.
Yes, his reaction was, "You say you're Stalin's daughter, the Stalin." But Robert Rayl, she gave him the manuscript she was carrying of 20 letters to a friend. And he immediately took it to the Russian-speaking section and could see that it was authentic. You know, at first, is this woman crazy? Is she a plant? Is she a spy? Who is she? But they decided that there was enough credibility given her book to her being Stalin's daughter. They had sent telegrams to the FBI and the you know, CIA and so on. And apparently the American government didn't know Stalin had a daughter, which is really interesting. Shows you how quietly and privately Stalin kept his daughter to himself. Any case, they decided to give her a visitor's visa because, in fact, she had been smart enough to demand her passport when she agreed to go back to Russia. It was a very unusual thing for a Soviet citizen to be able to carry their passport. But because she had her passport, she was given a visa and she was flown to the United States via Rome, stopped in Rome. But on the way, the embassy in New Delhi got a telex from the United States saying, have nothing to do with her, kick her out. But they had to reply, she's already on her way. They felt that they had the possibility of detente with the Soviets and they didn't want Stalin's daughter's defection to get in the way. As it turned out, the detente was an illusion anyway.
So let's talk about their arrival to the United States, because she does end up in there eventually, as you know. It's got the love of kind of is a kick in the face to the Soviet Union that the daughter of one of their leaders would end up in their enemy's territory, enemy camp, so to speak. So it's kind of a kick in the face, I feel like.
Completely, and she was considered to be the most important Soviet citizen to defect. What happened was when they landed in Rome, that is Robert Rayl, who accompanied her, the CIA officer undercover, who had been just a secretary and who was exposed as CIA in the process of investigation into her defection. When they landed,
wasn't a very good CIA then.
Pardon?
Wasn't a very good CIA then if he was exposed.
No, it wouldn't have been his responsibility. It would have been the embassy. Somehow, I think the rumor was there, and a reporter who reported it in the, I don't know, the New York Times, Washington Post, whatever, said that I am going to publish an article tomorrow saying that Robert Rayl is CIA. If you don't dispute it, it will go forward, and they didn't dispute it. But anyway, when they arrived in Rome, it turned out that because the Undersecretary of State, Foy Kohler, didn't want her in the United States, they had to find a place to park her. And they
I mean, you can't blame them, really. The daughter of, like I said, your enemy is wanted to defect to your country. You can't really blame them for not wanting her in there.
Well, you know, it's like not supporting Ukraine. I mean, you know, yeah, it's a principle. This woman is defecting, asking for asylum. And in fact, Svetlana, I kept coming across her political shrewdness. When she was at the embassy and they said, well, we're not sure we will take her, she said, I will report to the international press, and how will it look if the United States, the country of freedom and whatever, is unwilling to give freedom to Stalin's daughter? So in fact, they really didn't have much of a choice. But at that point, they were looking for a country to take her. And eventually the Swiss agreed. And so she was flown to Switzerland, where she went into hiding. The KGB was hunting for her, obviously, was looking, hoping for to be able to abduct her and take her back. The Americans were protecting her. And it became known that she had this book, 20 Letters to a Friend. So you talk of George Kennan, rather, he brought his friend, Edward Greenbaum, a lawyer, with him to Switzerland, and they decided to attempt to sell Svetlana's memoir. They offered it without anybody having permission to read it. And the woman who was translating it had to had to lock it up every night, could not take it home or out or whatever. It was a deep secret. In the end, they were able to secure $1 million for Svetlana
Wow.
for her book. Now, $1 million to a Soviet citizen is an illusion. She thought, you know, all she wanted was to be able to have a little apartment with a dog, and here she was, a millionaire. But it was her downfall because suddenly she became a hot ticket. Who could get the million from her?
So let's talk about when she gets a million. What's the next thing you should do after this?
When she gets to the United States?
Yeah, because she does meet someone as well, and again she does get married in American style.
When she lands, apparently there was more a bigger crowd to meet her than met the Beatles. I mean, she was a huge item, and she just spoke very briefly about the great relief she felt in being a country where you could speak your mind.
Did she speak English at this time, or did she?
Oh yes,
Had
she had Stalin had insisted she take English lessons when she was 10 years old, so that she could be present and translate what Churchill was saying. He didn't want to. He wanted somebody he completely trusted, i.e., his daughter, to be able to tell him what Churchill was saying when they had private meetings, which was not often, obviously. But he wanted his daughter to speak English, and she spoke very good English. In fact, then she tried to live a quiet life in Princeton and to work on her second book. And yes, she had a couple of affairs, but she walked into a trap, which was very strange. She was getting letters from a woman called Olga Vanna Wright, who was the wife of Frank Lloyd Wright, the great architect. Olga Vanna, Frank Lloyd Wright was dead, and Olga Vanna lived at the Taliesin Foundation's headquarters, which is very, very beautiful, as you possibly know, and is a kind of place where a number of intimates of the foundation live. Olga Vanna kept saying to Svetlana, her daughter, who had died years before, was called Svetlana, they were destined to meet, and so on. And eventually, Svetlana agreed to fly out to Wisconsin to meet Olga Vanna Wright. The irony was that Olga Vanna Wright was a Montenegrin, and she had spent time in Tbilisi, in Georgia, at the same time as Stalin had been there, and was about Stalin's age. For Olga Vanna Wright, Svetlana was prey. She could see that she was now a millionairess. Olga Vanna wanted money for her foundation, for the Taliesin Foundation, and she convinced her chief architect, who had been an apprentice of Frank Lloyd Wright, Wesley Peters, to court Svetlana. And quite cynically, he did. He had various reasons to feel indebted to Olga Vanna Wright, which I won't get into, but he courted her, and they were married. Svetlana was deeply in love with Wesley Peters and completely delusional. He was an architect who had projects in the Middle East, famous buildings he was working on, and her fantasy was that they would live quietly on a farm with a sheepdog and some cattle. And then she found herself pregnant. It was suggested by Olga Vanna that she have an abortion. She refused, and she gave birth to her daughter, her American daughter, in 1970. That would be, 17 years after her father's death. The relationship with Wesley Peters disintegrated. I got to know Svetlana's daughter very well, and she said she actually met her father 4 times. So that was the fate, but
But the marriage doesn't, again, the marriage doesn't work out as
it
well
doesn't
either.
work, and he fleeced her of all her money. By the time, even though she had legal advice and so on, she said a woman's Material possessions belonged to her husband, a very Soviet idea. Money didn't matter until she found that she was virtually without any money.
And that she was living in America, which didn't help.
Yeah. No, in America you need money. She didn't know that. Took her a while.
But I do believe she writes another book as well. She like said she wanted to become an author that she very much becomes, and it's another bestseller, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's only 1 year, and it's discrete chapters of her own memoir, of her own autobiography, her relationship with Brezhnev Singh, her description of her father, where she's very much more aggressively negative about his politics. So it's a good book. My preference is 20 Letters to a Friend, but this is a good book. And then she wrote two other books.
Mm.
But by that time, they were memoirs about her own life. And she discovered that Americans, or anyone actually, was not interested in her personal life so much as in her relationship with her father. And they weren't, it was very difficult to find publishers.
She did not want to talk. Or she finished with her father at this point, that she was tired of talking about him.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. She the last book is about her relationship with her two children in Moscow, which is a very moving account. But she did not find a publisher for it.
So you'd mentioned that at KGB, at least in the early years of her defection, they were hunting her, but eventually did they just give up and realize that if you take her down and bring her back, it would not look good, and she's a daughter of Stalin, and did they realize that if she even in the United States, though, that would not, as you know, that would not stop the KGB, but did they realize that then something would be up if we took care of her?
Did they give up? What happened initially was that there was total shock that she had managed to defect. And the ambassador to India was, of course, demoted seriously because he'd let her escape. But then they sought, the KGB sought under Andropov, sought to discredit her. One of the things that was very interesting, I mean, when you're writing a book like this, I, of course, applied to the CIA to get their files on various people, including, you know, especially Svetlana, but on the various people, the FBI, to various libraries. And one library, I had an assistant, Sim Smiley, who was a wonderful researcher, and she told me there was a collection of papers at Stanford. And they were put there by a woman who had attempted to write a biography of Svetlana in the 90s, Meryl Sequist, but who hadn't pursued it. I got the description of the papers and discovered that there were two KGB files in the collection. Now, you know, when I went to search for KGB material in 2011 to or 12 to 15, they were completely closed. Curiously, the files in Tbilisi had somehow, the whole area had been under, had caught fire. You know, there was going to be no access to KGB files. The only time there might have been access was right initially after the wall came down, but since then, no. And in these two KGB files, there were the strategies the KGB used to discredit Svetlana. One of the things, when I was lucky enough to have the phone numbers and addresses of her relatives in Moscow when I went there. And I went to visit her cousins. And one of them said something very curious happened with Joseph. Right at the time of Joseph, her son, right at the time of her defection, Joseph left his apartment in Moscow for the suburbs. And then very soon after that, he was back. Now, if you're Soviet, you're used to reading beneath the story, right? It was clear that at first Joseph refused to help the KGB, and then he acquiesced and got his status back. By then he was a doctor. So when I looked at these files, one file said under Andropov, said that they had to get the children to make public statements about their mother, that she was promiscuous, unreliable, alcoholic, etc. And these statements did come out from Joseph and Katya. Under pressure, they acquiesced. And then when the second book came out, the statement was that the people that Svetlana thanked in the book were the people who really wrote it. So they really seriously discredited her. Nobody took them seriously, I think, in the United States, but it was interesting that they made that effort. After that, there was one or two efforts at extraction, which didn't work. George Kennan writes about them. And then it was just leave her alone, let her go. What harm could she do? But to the end of her life, Svetlana was paranoid. When she was very ill at the in her last months, she had a lawyer's notice, which was given to the care facility where she was staying, that the minute she died, her body would be cremated. She didn't want her body being returned to the Soviet Union as if Stalin's daughter finally returned.
So I want to do forgive me for skipping a few years here, but from the 1990s, 1991, and the Soviet Union collapse, and what was her reaction when she read the news that was on television that the Soviet Union had finally collapsed? Were she happy, or were she kind of just, you know, it didn't mean anything to her at this point?
You know, when you're writing biography, you're dependent upon the documents that you can find or the people you can interview. I can't speculate on my subject's thinking unless I have grounds to do so. She had a wonderful friend, Mary, whom she wrote to. And it was as if she just expected this. This was kind of normal, and she didn't really trust it. But as I say, when in 1999, she wrote to Mary to say, Mary Burnett, that she couldn't believe that the Russian people would actually elect an ex-KGB goon. So she was hoping for an opening in the Soviet system. But remained a bit skeptical, and then when she finally proved to be correct. So other than that single letter, conversations with her daughter and others didn't elicit any information about her in the 90s. What she was concerned with, as per usual, was she wanted to reestablish connections with her daughter, Katya. When I talked to, Vasily's son, Stalin's grandson, Sasha Berdonsky, he said, you have to remember that Joseph and Katya, her daughter and son, had different parents. Joseph's father was Zdanov, and you could expect Joseph loved his mother, and the only thing he wanted to do was be with his mother in America. Katya, who was, did I say Zdanov? Joseph was Muratsov's son. Katya was Zdanov's son, who was a high party member, and she herself was a fierce communist, and she faltered her mother. But in the 90s, there was a reconciliation and an effort at some kind of reconnection. So that's the only preoccupation that Svetlana ever expressed to friends about that period.
Does she ever go back to Russia to meet her children again after the fall of the Soviet Union?
She did, no, she did before the fall of the Soviet Union.
What was the reunion like when she met her children again for the first time since 1960?
Well, again, these are always mysterious. It's as mysterious as us trying to figure out what's going on in Russia right now, right? There are so many possible interpretations of the narrative. In 1983, Svetlana was living in England. She had left the United States because she felt she had been manipulated by the CIA. And she didn't believe in public education. She thought public education was Soviet education, indoctrination. So she wanted to send her children to private school. And by this time, she'd run out of money. And so she thought she was going to take her, because her deepest connection to her mother was the brilliant education her mother had given her and insisted on. So she went back to the, she returned to the Soviet Union for two reasons. One, for her daughter's education, but two, because her son, Joseph, had written to her, said he was ill, he wanted to meet her in Iceland, etc. So she actually went back to the Soviet Union, to Moscow. And the meeting with Joseph was not successful. She did not feel, she felt that she'd been manipulated, and there's a good chance that she had been. Her experience of being in Moscow was that she was either offered, you know, a palatial residence, chauffeur, whatever, or she was vilified as Stalin's daughter, one or the other. It was going to be very hard for Olga to get an education unless she was indoctrinated by the pro-Soviets, or she was vilified. So in fact, after 6 months, they moved to Georgia. And it took a year and a half, but they eventually got back to the United States. So by 86, they were back there. And she never made an effort to leave the United States after that.
So you mentioned she had no money at this point, and, you know, her staying, what was it like to come back to the United States again and almost have no money? Because as we talked about in the United States, because, you know, the capitalist is a capitalist world, and like I said, you need money. So how did she come by at this point?
You know, she said at one point, I was born at the top of the heap. You know, there was a perfume that was sold in department stores in Moscow called Svetlana. She was born very, very wealthy if she had wanted access to money. And she had ended up poor. And she said, that's fate and that's okay. So what she stayed in Wisconsin, where they had subsidized residences for old age people. So she was in an old age home to the end of her life, and then taken to hospital when she was in an emergency. Now her daughter lived on the West Coast, which was the only, and she would have gone to the West Coast, but they didn't have the same kind of subsidized health care there.
Did she ever have a lot of contact with his daughter? Do we know her daughter living on the West Coast? Do we know if they had what was their relationship like? Do we know if it was warm, was it cold, or did they have a good relationship?
It was intimate and loving. When I first interviewed her, we were back at my small hotel room, and I watched the room darkened as the sun was going down. And she sat there and she said, you know, there were times, you couldn't tell why, but there were times when my mother fell back into the dark nightmare of childhood. And you couldn't console her. I have the impression, and probably actually Olga said it, that I'm not using her real name, said it, that sometimes she was the mother, and her mother was the child, and so, and also her mother took care of her. There was a moment one Mother's Day when Olga, put together breakfast for her mother and took it to her. And Svetlana said, "Oh, wow, it's Mother's Day. Let's do something wonderful. Let's move." So she had this strain of nomadism. She just moved from place to place to place. It was a very intimate and powerful relationship.
Do we know if her daughter wanted to meet her other half brothers or half sisters in Russia? Do we know if they ever met, and if what their relationship were like?
Yes, they met. Katya, if I remember correctly, refused to meet Svetlana, and so Olga didn't meet her. But she met Joseph, but it was, you know, there was no, the person she was most fond of was Sasha Berdonsky, Vasily's son. They had a lovely relationship. There were some other friends of Svetlana's, Lily Goldman, for instance, her black friend. They had a very good relationship, but she didn't establish any rapport with her brother. Who knows? There might have been jealousy there.
She refused to talk with interviews about Stalin, but and would you say that she is, you know, and I'm going to do a little bit comparison to the right now, and it's my, I don't know if it's a good comparison, but you know, ex mafiosi today, they kind of live out of, have to live out of the career of talking about the career. It's kind of the only way to make a living, right? Because, you know, they have to talk about what it was like being this and that. And I feel like that kind of was the way, only way that she could really make, maybe not, but you know, that's kind of the same with Svetlana, what she did, that her, the way she lived, her legacy, that she only could talk, the best way for her to make a living was talking about her past life in the growing up in the Soviet Union and under Stalin.
That would be too cynical. I mean, this is a woman who turned totally against the Soviet system. Mm. But when she was in London, for instance, she would march in anti-nuclear parades. She didn't feel that lives should be controlled by money. She did have some money left, maybe a couple hundred thousand. For the a long time, she and her daughter lived in a small town in Wisconsin. It was only because her daughter was offered a position on the West Coast that she went to the West Coast. But Svetlana had friends. She had her cat, a wonderful picture of her with her cat. And she wanted a quiet life. She didn't want to travel. She didn't want to, it would seem. You know, the idea that she could make money out of her father was not part of her lexicon. That was not something she wanted to do. She wanted to be as far from the mafioso circle as she could be.
She could have probably done it easily, right? Made probably millions out of talking about her father, going to, you know, conventions and that kind of things, and book, you know, book fairs, writing, published tons of material, I'm sure. But it's interesting that she chose not to do this. It's a, she's such a fascinating character to me.
Well, in fact, what's so to me compelling about Svetlana is she was never daunted. I mean, she kept reinventing herself. Sasha Brodansky also said to me, you must understand that Svetlana was never running from, she was running towards. She was running towards some, I can't find any other word than spiritual integration that he said she would never find, but she always believed it was possible. And I became a friend of a woman called Rosamund Richardson, who had written a book about the Stalin purges, and who had known Svetlana personally. And she did say what an extraordinarily intelligent, but also not mystical, but a person who did have a spiritual dimension to them, which is how she put it. What's so interesting is the idea that Svetlana might have been her father's daughter, but the genetic pool was empty when she entered, because she was as much an opposite to her father. Though she was stubborn, she could be fierce. She finally, after I think it's 10 years, she was allowed to become an American citizen. And she said she was very happy to become an American citizen. The only thing that was hard about swearing allegiance was that you had to swear allegiance that you would kill to support the Republic. She said, I could never kill anybody.
What would you say is the legacy of Svetlana?
I suppose her books. It would be interesting to now that we're back into a world that is so full of riddles and confusions and interpretations when it comes to the Soviet Union. When it comes to Russia. Contemporary Russia, you know, apparently there was another general in the hierarchy, in the Putin hierarchy, who was aware of what Prigozhin was doing. Now, what will his fate be? you know, who's going to get rumbled, who's going to survive, will Putin go, you know, what's happening among the criminal elite, etc. It would be interesting to take Svetlana's book, 20 Letters to a Friend, and her world, and my book, to see her perspective on how that world functions.
Like you said, she kind of predicted this when, you know, when she said, why would they elect him as president in 99?
That's right. In 2000, he was elected, but he was running in 99. Yeltsin had nominated him, and then he had his status as president confirmed in the 2000 election. I mean, and probably some of it was rigged, but not enough to, you know. And I spoke to wonderful historian at Columbia University who told me that when he was working in the Soviet Union on a regular basis, 50% of the population were pro-Stalin and 50% were anti. It was still a divided response. And it's what Putin is playing on, the idea of wanting to be a first world power. You know, I mean, I'm a Canadian. I'm not the least bit interested in that, right? But if you're American with your notion of American exceptionalism and so on, you do believe that you have to be the most important country in the world. And and Putin and Stalin were moving in that direction. I mean, the idea that Stalin was one of the three to negotiate the future of Germany and the world after the Second World War indicates the distance he brought the country at great cost, but made a lot of Russians very proud.
I think we've done a roundup up there. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Before I go, do you have anything you want to promote on the social media where people might find you or where people can buy your books? Should they be interested in reading more, which you absolutely should, about Svetlana?
My webpage is rosemarysullivan.com, and you will find places, including Amazon, for instance, where you can buy the book. There's a connecting link to something called Shepherd, which is a podcast where I've been invited to talk about my book, Villa Herbel, World War II, Escape in a House in Marseille. And of course, I am on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Thank you. Again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been Matt and Shmuel. Please check out some other episodes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like. And please like, share, and subscribe. We are available on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, wherever you can find podcasts these days. Please write a little review of us on iTunes if you like this episode. Thank you so much for coming, and I'll see you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.